Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're talking about income on today's show, the 1% and the 0.01% and everybody else. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl, who's in Mississippi reporting for our American Futures Project. It's Thursday, May 8th, and I'm glad to have you with us. Fed Chair Janet Yellen has been testifying on Capitol Hill, and it's safe to say she feels pretty good about most of the economy. I say most of the economy because housing is a whole nother thing.
A sector that has been recovering since 2011 have remained disappointing so far this year and will bear watching.
So how do you solve a problem like housing? And if we can't solve it, what does that mean for the rest of the economy? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
2 years after the housing market bottomed out, we still have plenty of situations like this.
On my street, there are 3 abandoned or foreclosed properties that are empty. You know, there's a decaying speedboat in the backyard.
Stephanie Risk is a homeowner in Laurel, Maryland, and she put her house up for sale last year. Didn't sell.
It's really hard to sell a house when there are literally no neighbors because the houses are empty.
Sales activity of both new and existing homes have really not recovered to anywhere near the levels that we would have expected in a normal recovery.
That is Chris Mayer, professor of real estate at Columbia Business School. He says we would expect to see maybe 2 million housing starts a month, but we are actually seeing less than 1 million. The problem for economists, including those at the Federal Reserve, is that when people don't buy homes, they don't buy a lot of other things either.
When you buy a home, one of the first things you do is go out and get new furniture, talk to contractors, supply companies.
And don't forget the real estate agents and the lawyers. In the past, economic recovery depended on this, depended on housing. Nicholas Ritsinas lectures on real estate at Harvard Business School.
If you go back to the last 6 or 7 recessions, it was the secret sauce.
No longer, he says. It's a smaller part of the economy now, and it's just not recovering quickly.
It still has some punch, but the punch may not be what it once was.
If housing isn't the main driver of the economy now, then what is? Ritsina says he doesn't know. Maybe there just isn't one. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Heads up if you buy lots of diapers, paper towels, or shoes online. You listening? FedEx has announced that starting next year, shipping on all ground packages will be determined by size. Analysts say that could lead to a price spike on 30% of the company's shipments, primarily stuff that's lightweight but bulky. Again, diapers, paper towels, and shoes. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on the ripple effect this change could have.
So let's say, hypothetically, I've taken a break in my withering workday to do a little online shopping for cushions. I'm looking for the right design.
Here we go. Ooh, look at this handsome X. Perfect. Let me get a couple.
The question is, what'll happen to my shipment of cushions and pretty pink and yellow cushion covers under FedEx's new policy? We know one thing is certain.
We don't want to scare anybody, but there could be a 10 to 15% rate increase for some shippers next year.
Travis Burt runs Transportation Impact, a firm that helps shippers reduce shipping costs. Yes, prices will go up, but people in the business say there may be a way around me and my pillow retailer paying it, especially if cost, not speed, is the primary consideration. Local couriers and even the U.S. Postal Service are ready and willing, says Kent Smith with Ursa Major Associates.
Sophisticated e-commerce mailers will manage it in stride because they're not tied to a single deliverer.
So my pillows might not fly with the familiar FedEx, and supply chain consultant Mark Wolfrat says the ride might not be as cozy either.
Today, if you put an item in a box and it doesn't fill the full height, they add airbags, paper. Well, that space in the box is now costing them money.
Wolfrat says he expects to see companies tailor box size to the precise dimensions of what's being shipped. Am I willing to have my pillows a little squished on a journey that takes a few more days than it used to? If it saves me $10, you know I am. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Can't wait to see those cushions, Dan. On Wall Street today, more up and down. Details when we do the numbers. Last week, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, the senior reporter on our wealth and poverty desk, did a story about how likely it is that anyone in the United States will spend even a little part of his or her life in the 1%. Well, a lot of you had a lot of questions about that piece, and Chrissy has come in to answer a few of them. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, David.
So the essence of your story is that at some point, 1 in 8 Americans is going to make it into the 1% of earners for at least 1 year. And I was looking at Facebook, and a Marketplace listener named Andrew Tong said, that may be true in terms of income, but it's certainly not based on net worth. Just talk to me a bit about the distinction that he's making there.
Yeah, and I think that Andrew brings up a really important point. We hear the phrase 1% a lot, but we often are using it, and economists are using it in different ways and in different contexts. So in this story, we were talking about the 1% in terms of income, meaning the money that a household makes in the course of a year, mainly through their salary, though the data also counted money that a family might have gotten through a one-time inheritance in a given year, a one-time cash inheritance.
So how much money would that be in terms of dollars these days?
So a household would have to make more than about $340,000 in a year to be considered part of the 1%. But as Andrew and several others point out, there's how much money you make in a year, and then there's the net worth or the wealth that you have, which means the total money you have in the bank plus the value of your homes, your car, your investments, minus, of course, all your debts.
Whole shebang there, yeah.
Exactly. And to be in that top 1% in terms of wealth is a much higher bar. It's estimated that you'd have to be worth more than $8 million or so these days to be in the top 1% in terms of wealth.
So you mentioned we hear so much about the 1%. I was struck looking at the comments how many people brought up the fact that there's another subset, the 0.1%, and even another subset, the 0.01%. What do we know about those groups?
Right. To quote one Facebook commenter, Carl Swanson, we are the 99.99% is more accurate but less catchy.
Put that on a T-shirt, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It takes slightly longer on the side. But it is true that the most intense rise in incomes that we've seen in the last 40 years is among the top 0.1%, and even more than that, the top 0.01%. And the kind of income that they're getting is mostly not from a wage, but from things like capital gains, money made from investments in real estate or in the stock market. It's a different kind of money we're talking about.
Again, you were focusing here on getting into that 1% for a year, maybe 2 years, which made me and a bunch of other people sort of wonder about economic mobility and how difficult it is to climb from one class in America to another.
Yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag. The chances of reaching the top are much higher if you're white than if you're black or Latino. The good news is that in the U.S., people are making more than their parents by and large, but they're often not actually getting out of the class that their parents were in, because everybody's making more.
Chrissy Clark is the senior reporter for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. You can find a link to her piece on making it to the 1% on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
So a kid commits a crime. He spends some time in juvenile detention. Maybe there's some rehab. Who pays for that? You might think the cost is covered by taxpayers and factored into state budgets. Well, increasingly, not so much. A portion of those costs is being passed on to families. Youth Radio spent the last year investigating the impact those fines and fees have on those families, and they focused on California, which has the highest population of incarcerated youth in the country. Miles Bess brings us this story.
Standing in the hallway outside a hearing room at the Alameda County Juvenile Justice Center, you see benches filled with teenagers and their families, waiting to appear in court. Many dressed up in button-downs and ties, looking their Sunday best. A lot of moms, too, and little brothers and sisters who'd clearly rather be elsewhere.
I'm so hungry.
Many teens are here for trials and probation hearings, but on any given day, others are trying to negotiate fines and fees. The bill starts adding up before the courtroom, when you're arrested. Even if you're innocent, in Alameda County, the investigation alone will cost you $250.
You get fines for the public defender. You get charged for incarceration.
That's Deborah Mendoza, probation officer turned advocate, who can list fees off the top of her head.
And there's a fee for being in juvenile hall. There's a daily fee for if you're in GPS. There's a.
If you total the average fees for a juvenile, it's close to $2,000. It's parents who are responsible for the bill, and that's the trend across the country. Legal scholar Lauren Brookeisen from NYU's Brennan Center for Justice.
There are more and more criminal justice fees that are added every single year in this country. In recent years, about 20 state legislatures passed laws holding parents responsible for their children's crimes.
In California, parents have the right to negotiate fees, but it's not easy. If they don't pay, officials can garnish parents' wages, take their tax refunds, or place liens against their property. In Alameda County, one of the poorest in the San Francisco Bay Area, half of the fees charged to parents remain unpaid.
Sometimes it is more expensive administratively to collect these fees than the money you're actually receiving in revenue. Well, that's the great irony of the situation.
Step over to my office.
Back at the courthouse, Joshua Hopkins is sitting on a bench waiting to be called into a hearing. Hopkins is 13, but he looks a lot older.
People mess with me and then they get me frustrated. They just like to push my buttons. And then I get very upset and I fight.
The fighting has led to time in juvenile detention. And that adds up to a lot of fees, according to his mom, LaPortia John.
So I owe a total of $736.
Miss John owes the money, even though her son's not in her care. Because of a mental health issue, Joshua lives in a private group home. But his mom is still responsible for the court fees when he messes up.
He is my son. He's my son. But I'm getting hurt because it's financially creating hardship.
That's part of being a parent. You know, you're responsible for your kids and their actions.
That's Terry Wiley, assistant district attorney for Alameda County's juvenile division. If young people and their families have a problem paying, Wiley says there's a straightforward solution.
Don't be committing crimes and you won't owe any money. Very simple.
For Zoe Matthews, it's not simple at all. In 2010, her son Deshaun Morris was incarcerated for the better part of a year. Months after being released from jail, he was shot and killed. Her son was dead, but the debt lived on, including ongoing calls from county collections.
It's a constant reminder that, no, he's not here anymore.
Matthew's son was locked up for 208 days at a cost of almost $30 a day.
By being incarcerated, you're paying your debt back to society. So then they're going to charge you an additional per night stay as if there were some options. The bills are additional stress to already a very painful situation that I will be dealing with for the rest of my life.
Matthew says the county has agreed to reduce her monthly payment, but won't reduce the total bill. $7,500 for her deceased son's fees. In Oakland, California, I'm Miles Best for Marketplace.
Double Charged is a special investigation into the U.S. juvenile justice system produced by Youth Radio. Coming up,
when you have Jay Leno standing outside your hotel and waving a sign of boycott, you are going to be worried.
The Beverly Hills Hotel and the Sultan of Brunei. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bumped up 32 points, 0.2%, and at 16,550. The NASDAQ slid 16 points, 0.4%, down to 4051. And the S&P 500 shaved off 2 points to close at 1875. Some bad earnings scared off investors today. Tesla throttled down 11% after announcing a $50 million loss. 21st Century Fox was up 6.5% on strong quarterly earnings. The broadcaster had higher ad sales and a really popular Super Bowl, despite the fact that it was a blowout. Japan's Nikkei index added nearly 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.61%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology holds a hearing titled Space Traffic Management: How to Prevent a Real-Life Gravity. The Labor Department releases its job openings and labor turnover survey for March. And Mother's Day was declared a national observance 100 years ago by President Woodrow Wilson. Make those brunch reservations. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. When you buy a book, chances are you're paying a discounted price for it. That trend started with big bookstores like Barnes & Noble and Borders back in the 1980s. Now, it's websites like Amazon bringing you books on the cheap. Audrey Quinn looks at the practice of book discounting and at what's left after all the markdowns.
If you want to get a sense of just how dramatic online book pricing can be, it helps to go to a local bookstore, like Eight Cousins Books in Falmouth, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Carol Chittenden's the owner there. She let me play price check. We have Michael Lewis's Flash Boys here. How much are you selling that for?
$22.36.
Let me look that up on Amazon. So Amazon's got it for $16.77. That's a lot less.
I think that's a little less than we could buy it for from the publisher.
This comparison game is clearly not so fun for Chittenden. We do the same thing for another bestseller, The Goldfinch. Her store sells it for $24. Amazon sells it for $17. Online's looking like the way better deal. Let's keep going here. How about your guys' notebooks? We got
$12.95.
And on Amazon, the notebooks are about the same price. It turns out just about everything Eight Cousins Books sells that isn't a book, it's pretty much the same price as Amazon. And it's the same with other bookstores, other online sites. Online has way cheaper book prices. But compare other products and that price difference goes away. What is it about books? Is it more that the online places are... Do you have to get...
Eight Cousins, this is Carol.
Chittenden has to take a phone order, so we'll ask Oren Tyker. He's CEO of the American Booksellers Association. Just speaking as a product, why is it that books get discounted so much?
Books are the one significant product left in the marketplace today in which the manufacturer actually prints the suggested retail price on the product.
This price on the product thing, it means book markdowns are super visible. Sellers can be like, here's our price, and look at the back of the book. That's what publishers want us to sell it for. See, we're giving you deals, which can be a pretty convenient psychological device, especially if you're a big retailer with lots of other stuff to sell.
When the customer sees a book at 40, 50% off, the presumption is that everything else that that retailer is selling is also equally inexpensive.
And books bring in some pretty attractive consumers.
Yeah, book buyers are good customers. They tend to be slightly more affluent. They tend to be consumers who shop and therefore are always in the marketplace for other products.
Books are kind of getting used here.
So it really devalues the whole concept of the book. And the book is very important to our culture.
That's Dennis Johnson. He's founder of Melville House. It's a publisher in Brooklyn. He's worried about these discounts in the book industry, but he's not about to stop selling his books to Amazon.
That would be very stupid business. They're the biggest part of our sales, and my core job as a publisher is to sell books.
Hardcover sales are actually on the rise. They're growing faster than ebooks. And despite all the online discounts, the American Booksellers Association says sales at independent bookstores are growing too. Booksellers say the localism trend, shopping at local farmers markets, drinking local microbrews, it's also driven sales at independent booksellers. Back at Eight Cousins Books, Carol Chittenden's finished up her phone call.
I feel that booksellers are very powerful, in fact, because we're very involved in our communities and our customers are so loyal.
That phone call she was on, it was a customer asking her to special order a book, so he didn't have to buy it on Amazon. In Falmouth, Massachusetts, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
It's about 8,000 miles, give or take, from Los Angeles to Brunei in Southeast Asia. They're an ocean apart. The Sultan of Brunei has announced there will be Sharia law in that island nation, and that has caused a stir on the other side of the Pacific. You see, the Beverly Hills Hotel, a Los Angeles landmark, is run by a company owned by the Sultan of Brunei, and some big Hollywood stars have decided to boycott a place that's known as the Pink Palace. Sharon Waxman is the founder of The Wrap, and she's here to talk about what this may mean for the Beverly Hills Hotel. Hey there, Sharon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'm just curious how a group of celebrities, and here we're talking about Richard Branson, Ellen DeGeneres, Jay Leno, others, became interested in what's going on in the nation of Brunei.
Well, it just so happens that the Sultan of Brunei, who's in charge over there, is one of the wealthiest men on the planet. And among his holdings is a set of luxury hotels called the Dorchester Collection, which includes probably the most iconic hotel in Hollywood, which is the Beverly Hills Hotel. And so when this law became known, it started to spread kind of on social media and in the celebrity community about this discrimination against gays and women. And so what has happened is that this has boomeranged against the hotel. And Jay Leno was among a bunch of protesters who were out front calling for a boycott of the hotel this week.
Events have been moved, parties have been moved already. And I wonder if you're getting the sense that sort of there are economic teeth to these protests, that it's starting to affect the hotel or to worry the hotel that these events are moving.
I think it absolutely is worrying the hotel. I mean, when you have Jay Leno standing outside your hotel and waving a sign of boycott, you are going to be worried. The CEO of the Dorchester Collection put out a statement. I have to say I feel badly for the man because he's trying to defend, you know, the interests of his hotel and his employees, which has nothing to do with the policy and laws being passed in Brunei. And he has no power over that. That's his boss. That's his owner. And so he put out this statement that just said, basically, you know, please don't take out your anger on this establishment, whose loyal employees have nothing to do, who will be economically affected by this, and who have nothing to do with the goings on half a world away. And that's, of course, entirely valid, but it hasn't seemed to have had any effect because, and I should point out that a couple of the events that have been canceled are, events honoring women. And so there was a conversation, I think, internally among organizations that were holding events there thinking, you know, this is really hypocritical. How can we have an event honoring women at a hotel owned by somebody who clearly has no respect for the civil rights, the human rights of women?
We've heard from the head of this hotel chain, as you mentioned. Have we heard from the man himself? Have we heard from the Sultan himself?
Interesting question. I don't think the Sultan of Brunei has great media relations advice, and he probably is not accustomed to having to come up against, the media influence of the level of people who have been protesting against his policy. He has said nothing at all, but, you know, he certainly is in the economic position where he can say, I don't care.
Sharon Waxman, founder of The Wrap, talking to us today about the Beverly Hills Hotel. Thanks, Sharon.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Earlier this year, Forbes released its list of the world's billionaires, and that's the 0.01% Chrissy Clark was talking about earlier. Maybe even the 0.001%. Anyway, missing from the list are the billionaires from centuries past. Well, fortunately, author and satirist Christopher Buckley has kept tabs on that list, and he's written an essay called A Short History of the Billionaire. Today, he brings us a profile of one early American success story.
Gilead Sam Starbuck, Boston, 1775. Net worth, $140,000, silver. Profession, tea. In December 1773, Starbuck was purser on the New Bedford whale ship Incontinent when it put into Boston Harbor to offload. Observing a crowd of Bostonians oddly dressed as Native Americans and hurling bricks of valuable English tea into the harbor, he lowered one of Incontinent's whaleboats and rescued some of the 45 tons of jettisoned tea. Opened his first tea shop in Braintree several days later, serving a beverage called salt tea. When salt tea failed to catch on, he rebranded it Patriot Tea, which did eventually find acceptance with Boston's tea-starved public. His string of tea shops prospered, but scholars argued that Starbuck made a mistake calling them Gileads instead of some other catchier name.
Complete list of early billionaires and other satire by Christopher Buckley can be found in his most recent collection entitled But Enough About You.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This final note, something I'd heard about when I was growing up in North Carolina, but sounded like a myth. For more than 90 years, Davidson College, a liberal arts college in western North Carolina, has offered students this perk. It has, and here I'm quoting the Charlotte Observer, washed, dried, folded, and ironed students' clothes for free. Well, no more. Davidson College's president says that starting next year, students will have to use washers and dryers themselves. She's decided the $400,000 that pays for the laundry service could be better spent on things like research and keeping the library open 24/7. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. Join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.